of meat and fresh produce.
The United States border with Mexico has witnessed an influx of asylum seekers in recent weeks, with thousands, mostly Haitians, massing there after fleeing poverty in their home country. The migrants reached the Rio Grande after a long, treacherous journey. Images showed people with toddlers staying in squalid tents under a bridge in the Texan border town of Del Rio. But as usual, U.S. authorities began removing and expelling and, in some cases, cracking down on refugees despite criticism at home and abroad. On Thursday, U.S. Special Envoy to Haiti, Daniel Foote, resigned in a fiery letter over what he called inhumane expulsions of asylum seekers. The United Nations also demanded an end to the mass expulsion, with UN Refugee Chief calling it inconsistent with international norms. The United Nations Human Rights Office particularly expressed concern over the ill treatment of migrants at the southern U.S. border.
Like, we are disturbed by the images we've seen and by the fact that we've seen all these migrants and refugees and asylum seekers being transported to Port-au-Prince. We are seriously concerned by the fact that it appears that there has not been any individual assessment on the case.
Condemnations poured in after images showing predominantly white federal agents on horseback whipping and chasing migrants went viral on social media. Human rights groups say such incidents are reminiscent of the disturbing U.S. history of racial and ethnic violence.
The United States has been in existence. It has exploited African people, no matter where African people have been dispersed around the world by Europeans.
The Mexican president, whose country has been the main transit for U.S.-bound migrants, called on his American counterpart to deal with the root cause of the migrant problem. Andrés Manuel López Obrador urged the U.S. to invest in the countries from where migration originates. As the U.S. continues to grapple with the influx of migrants, it remains to be seen whether the Biden administration prevents the crisis on its southern border in a humane way or continues breaking its promises to welcome migrants into the country.
Nerves are growing more frayed in the EU ahead of wintertime. Gas prices have soared by 250% since the start of the year, and supplies are depleting. Almost half of all gas used in the EU is imported from Russia, but relations between the bloc and Moscow are at an all-time low. Analysts say it's not surprising, therefore, that the Kremlin is reluctant to increase supplies. The crisis has been discussed at a meeting of EU energy ministers attended by senior European Commission officials.
We have to end our dependence on foreign volatile fossil fuels as soon as possible. We also need to take energy efficiency seriously.
Experts say ordinary, hard-pressed citizens are now paying the price because the EU refuses to dial down its anti-Russia rhetoric.
It's not possible to expect that European Union will export its rules, its behavior, all its values to everybody in this neighborhood. But it seems to me that the feeling here sometimes in the political bodies of the European Union is the following. If others are not taking the internal rules of the European Union, that does mean that they are wrong, that they are incorrect.
Gas prices have shot up due to demand because economies are bouncing back from the pandemic. In the EU, last winter and spring were colder than usual, and so gas reserves in the 27-nation bloc were hit. Since then, power grids have not benefited much from wind energy due to mild weather conditions. Moscow and Berlin want the speedy approval of Nord Stream 2, the controversial pipeline under the Baltic Sea that will double Russian gas exports to Germany. Completed earlier this month, the pipeline cannot start delivering gas until it clears regulatory hurdles here in the European Commission. The United States is very much against the Russian-German gas pipeline, and analysts say Washington is putting the EU under pressure to try and delay things. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Millions of energy customers face spiraling price hikes as several smaller firms in the market have collapsed in a matter of days. Avro Energy and Green ceased trading on Wednesday, with existing customers now faced being put onto expensive new tariffs, with the energy regulator warning there could be more bad news ahead.
It's not unusual for suppliers to go out of the market. I think what's different this time is that dramatic change in the costs that those suppliers are facing. So we've had around sort of, you know, we've had five roughly over the past few months. We've had a number more at the start of the year.
Business Minister Kwasi Kwarteng has already said there will be no bailout for the majority of energy firms, but the government will instead focus on the plight of the customer.
The government has been clear that protecting consumers is our primary focus and shapes our entire approach to this issue. We will continue to protect consumers with the energy price cap.
On the streets of the British capital, there were fears of what a price hike would mean, but also calls for accountability.
It's unacceptable. Everything is going high, even the price of food and everything is going high. Even the public transport, everything is going high. So the government, they should do something about that.
Are you worried that your bills might increase this winter?
Yes, I am. I'm a pensioner. I'm very worried about it.
At some point, there has to be a reason as to why this has happened, whether it could have been foreseen, whether things could have been done to prevent it. The people who run the energy companies, how much money have they made? How much money have they taken off and shipped offshore? That should be looked at.
The British consumer has had a tough couple of months. First of all, dealing with the uncertainty around Brexit, the fallout from the COVID crisis, and now the prospect of spiraling energy costs.
Once more, it will be the most vulnerable who may yet again bear the brunt of any drastic price hikes this winter, with some households having to choose between heating and eating. Amina Taylor, London.
Former Catalan regional leader Carles Puigdemont must stay in Sardinia, Sassari judge ruled on Friday. The politician had been arrested by the Italian police upon his arrival to the Sardinian town of Alghero on Thursday night. Puigdemont had reportedly travelled there to attend a conference, but he was put in custody as soon as he stepped onto Italian soil. He was detained under an international arrest warrant issued by Spain over his alleged involvement in the unilateral independence referendum and the subsequent unilateral declaration of independence of Catalonia 4 years ago. Puigdemont is now a member of the European Parliament living in Belgium. Tens of supporters of the politician demonstrated outside the Sassari court, calling for his release.
Later on Friday, former Catalonia president Puigdemont was released by a local court, but the politician will have to remain in Sardinia until questions such the validity of the European arrest warrant against him and his immunity status are resolved. Should the arrest be considered valid, the same court will have to decide whether to hand him over to the Spanish authorities.
Italy's Justice Ministry, on its side, has made clear it had played no role in the case, which, quote, was the sole preserve of the judges involved. Max Civili, Rome.
Islamic and national factions in the Gaza Strip held a protest in solidarity with Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails who are under hunger strike and are subjected to Israeli abuse. The event that included Friday prayer in front of the Red Cross headquarters came a day after an ex-prisoner, Hussein Masalma, died of cancer after being detained for 19 years.
We are here in front of the Red Cross to remind the international human rights organizations of their role to protect our prisoners inside Israeli jails and who are under solitary confinement. There are six prisoners under hunger strike protesting the inhumane Israeli abuse against them and the illegal administrative detention. This is not the only medical negligence of hundreds of our prisoners, but an international killing practiced by the Israeli regime.
Al-Masalma's medical condition deteriorated due to complications resulting from Israeli medical negligence and torture at the time he was in custody that led to his inevitable slow death.
There is no doubt that Palestinian detainees are witnessing tough measures and abuse inside the Israeli jails, especially following the escape operation. Yesterday, Al-Masalma succumbed to his cancer that deteriorated while being in jail. There are more than hundreds of inmates who have lost their lives in Israeli jails due to intentional medical negligence.
Palestinian factions say they won't sit idle while Israeli violations against the prisoners are increasing, urging the international community to take serious action to save the prisoners' life.
We are holding Friday prayer here in front of the Red Cross to express our support to our prisoners who are a symbol of our Palestinian cause. We will always be proud of their patience. Our message to the Israeli regime is clear. We hold Israel responsible for the lives of our prisoners and we won't remain silent over these violations.
Palestinian detainees are passing through hard medical conditions as 15 inmates inside Israeli jails are diagnosed with cancer, while more than 200 others have lost their lives as a result of the Israeli systematic policy of medical negligence.
While hundreds of Palestinian detainees, including women and children, are subjected to inhumane violations of their rights inside Israeli jails, Palestinians here are paying efforts demanding the international community to break its silence over the prisoners' issue. Roba Shabbat, Gaza.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghudde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel. Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
February 27th, 2021. Although Lady Zainab had lost her son, a brother and relatives, she was supportive and a companion until the last moments. But the culmination of Zainab's role is after the incident, when nothing was left of the relationship and she had the first role. In Shia literature, it is often said that blood prevails over the sword in the event of Karbala. The cause of this victory was Lady Zainab. If it wasn't for Lady Zainab, peace be upon her, the blood in Karbala would have been forgotten. On the day of Ashura, a military confrontation ended with the apparent defeat of the forces of truth. But what turned this apparent military defeat into a definite, permanent victory was Lady Zainab's role. The role played by Lady Zainab, peace be upon her, was the continuation of the movement of Imam al-Hussein alayhi as-salam. And if it were not for her, that uprising would have been lost in the history.
Subhanallah, hamdan lillah, wa la
This incident showed that women are not on the margins of history and subordinate to men. The Shia woman is at the center of important historical events. Relying on her faith and religion, a woman acts in a way to humiliate an enemy at the center of his power, while he has ostensibly won the military campaign and has crushed his opponent and leaned on the throne of victory. She put the eternal stigma on his forehead and changed his victory into defeat. This is what Lady Zainab, peace be upon her, has done. Lady Zainab, peace be upon her, showed that women's hijab and decency can be turned into an eternal honor. Is it not this example a perfect proof that women in Islam are in the context of politics and society, and that the monotheistic traditions and religion do not want women to be inferior, but it places them at the top of the human peaks?
In the limelight.
In recent years, the U.S. and its European allies have decreased the number of ground troops deployed overseas in the so-called War on Terror, turning instead to airstrikes, while their local partners carry out ground operations. This increasing reliance on aerial warfare, which renders nearly invisible the identity of the military force that kills a civilian, has made it all but impossible for civilians to get compensation for the loss of family members. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Fasham Majid Ryder. This article is published under the heading, U.S. Military Often Kills Civilians and Rarely Offers Compensation. Stay tuned, please, for the second part of this article. In Iraq, where U.S. operations were primarily conducted by air, news reports suggest that only around 14 payments have been made since operations against Daesh began in 2014. In 2019, only 6 Iraqis received sympathy payments compared to the 605 payments issued in Afghanistan. In 2020, no sympathy payments were issued globally. Most ex-gratia payments are small, usually between $2,500 and $5,000. One of the condolence payments issued in 2019 was only $131, with ex-gratia payments being distributed in line with its counterterrorism interest. U.S. policy offers no clear means for civilians whose families have been killed and whose homes have been destroyed in bombing campaigns to seek restitution. Not only is there no clear pathway for civilians seeking compensation, but also, as Shill notes, Even internationally recognized NGOs and human rights organizations have struggled to identify the right point of contact to bring cases or to request ex gratia payments. So given that, it's hard to imagine what it would be like to be a sole civilian in one of these countries already grieving from an unimaginable loss and then trying to figure out what to do next. For the US-European allies, the legal avenues to compensation vary. In the UK, claims follow the guidelines of the Geneva Conventions, under which one can only file a civil claim for wrongful death if the person can prove that the harm to civilians was disproportionate to the military gain from whatever operation killed them. That basically means that unless it is an egregious case, it is very hard to prove that it was unlawful, and certainly without access to the decision-making process or the decision-making documentation, it is very hard to prove, says Mark Latimer of the Ceasefire Center for Civilian Rights, an organization that advocates for reparations for civilians. That's one of the reasons why successful cases, and there have been hundreds of successful cases, are all basically to do with abuses in detention, he adds. The detention cases occurred when UK ground forces were still fighting in Iraq, but once they limited their operations to bombings, civilians stopped having a route to compensation. In late April, the UK further entrenched legal barriers to compensation, passing the Overseas Operations Act, a law that sets the hard 6-year limit for anyone wishing to bring a civil harm against the UK's armed forces for acts committed overseas. The act has started a ticking clock for civilians who might have legitimate claims that they are unaware of. The Overseas Operations Act is now basically an act to protect the government and the Ministry of Defense and the UK government from civil liability under the pretense of protecting veterans, says Latimer. The US and many of its allies use coalition operations as an excuse to weasel out of responsibility for civilian deaths that occurred during anti-ISIS operations in Iraq and Syria. An individual nation's airstrikes are attributed to the entire coalition, but the coalition states that members often share intelligence and coordinate on airstrikes. This complicates establishing the chain of responsibility, and while the coalition may say there is joint responsibility for a strike, it has no mechanism for addressing the harm, leaving it up to individual member states to take responsibility. Sahar Muhammad Ali, who has worked for more than 2 decades for CIVIC and is the current head of its West Asia region program, remembers advising coalition members and the Pentagon to create a joint standard operating procedure in the lead-up to the war against ISIS. She says, "I'm being very honest with you. They said no. I mean, the UK, Australia, France, everybody said no." The UK, France, and Belgium have refused to acknowledge any civilian casualties during the battle for Mosul, a claim experts find absurd. Chris Woods, the director of Air Wars, says, "You cannot bomb cities and towns without significant civilian harm. It's just not possible. And any belligerent that claims otherwise is in complete denial and is representing an entirely false picture to their home populations." On top of that, member nations of the coalition rarely investigate the civilian cost of their strikes. In 2017, at the height of the Battle of Mosul, the UK shuttered the team it had established in 2010 to investigate crimes committed during the Iraq War. Vladimir says, as far as we are aware, the only team working on civilian casualties is the press office. Dutch media discovered that the Netherlands was responsible for an airstrike that killed at least 70 civilians in the Iraqi town of Hawija in 2015. This caused a massive scandal in the Netherlands, with lawmakers forced to address the issue in Parliament. The Netherlands announced a several million euro fund to reconstruct Hawija, but at least 50 civilians from the town are still actively seeking compensation. Zeg Veld, the Dutch lawyer, represents the civilians who were injured or lost relatives due to Hawija's strike. She is hopeful that they will receive compensation, but believes that the Dutch role in their plight would never have been public if not for media efforts. That's the sad situation, that no one takes responsibility for anything. And there is no investigation into civilian casualties whatsoever, she says. That's exactly what the coalition is doing behind the veil of their coordinated attacks. Everyone is responsible and no one is responsible. There will be no investigation into facts whatsoever, let alone recognition of liability, she says. The Hawija scandal was a large-scale disaster, but according to Woods of Air Wars, the great majority of civilian deaths in war occur in small-scale events, of which there are a very large number. No one civilian killed here, two civilians killed there. Very low incident civilian harm, but which culminatively accounts for the majority of civilian deaths over the duration of conflict. On September 17th, the U.S. acknowledged that its drone strike in Afghanistan had killed seven civilians, calling it a tragic mistake. This admission came after intense media scrutiny that cases like Khazar's never receive. She has very few expectations that the killing for her son will receive such treatment. As far as she knows, no one has investigated the circumstances of his death, nor has anyone reached out to her. In all likelihood, no one ever will. Khazar knows this, noting, "Those who bomb don't compensate."
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello, welcome to the Spotlight. I'm Kavit Akhli. The Kremlin warned that any expansion of NATO military infrastructure in Ukraine would cross one of President Vladimir Putin's red lines. What are Putin's red lines, especially when it comes to Ukraine? Meanwhile, Belarus has said that it had agreed to take action with Moscow to counter growing NATO activity. In this edition of the Spotlight, we will look at whether Ukraine is brewing to be a flashpoint again between Russia and the U.S., and what Russia will do now that one of its red lines has been crossed.
Russia has warned NATO against setting up military infrastructure in Ukraine. It comes after Belarusian President Alexander Lukashenko said the United States is creating military bases in Ukraine under the guise of establishing training centers. Lukashenko said he has discussed the issue with his Russian counterpart, Vladimir Putin, and they agreed to take action to counter the growing NATO activity.
It's actions that will provide further strategic interests and security of our two allied states. The issue of potential expansion of NATO military infrastructure in Ukraine was numerously mentioned by President Putin, and President Putin said it was beyond the red line he had talked about repeatedly.
Moscow has time and again warned against NATO's expansion in Ukraine, saying it is a red line the West will regret crossing. Last week, Russia held large-scale joint military drills with Belarus. The maneuvers followed Ukraine's joint war games with the U.S. and other NATO member states. Tensions have been simmering between Moscow and Kiev since the ouster of Ukraine's elected president Viktor Yanukovych in a U.S.-backed revolt in 2014. The tensions further escalated after Crimea declared autonomy from Ukraine to reunite with the Russian Federation. The so-called revolution in Ukraine and Kiev's subsequent reach out to NATO could be part of a puzzle being pieced together by the United States and its allies to contain Russia militarily.
Well, joining us for this edition of the Spotlight, we have Executive Vice President of the Eurasia Center, Earl Rasmussen, who joins us from Minneapolis. Also, radio host and political analyst Tim Kirby, who joins us from Moscow.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
I'd like to welcome you both. Tim Kirby, let me first start with you. You have a warning coming from the Kremlin that any expansion of NATO military infrastructure, as it has been termed, in Ukraine would cross one of Vladimir Putin's red lines. First, what NATO infrastructure is he referring to? I'm sure it's not just a couple guns.
No, what they're referring to is the possibility that essentially, especially the U.S. or NATO as a whole, is trying to preemptively build bases before Ukraine would be to join NATO. However, we should go back a few years in time. The leadership of the breakaway republics out east in the Donbass both claimed that whereas NATO says they've offered basically soldiers to train the locals to protect themselves, the breakaway republics consider them to be mercenaries and believe that the concept of this training process has been used to masquerade different operations, especially by mercenaries.
Just to rewind a little bit here, when you say mercenaries, can you expand a little bit more for us on that?
Well, judging by some of the, let's just say, not so fortunate people who have, especially Polish or other Eastern European citizenship, you know, the United States, Poland, Germany, Where else have they found people from? Thinking possibly Romania. None of these countries have entered this war on an official capacity, but time and again you happen to find, or at least according to the Breakaway Republics, you happen to find a dead body with that particular identification on it. So there does seem to be, at least if you believe the Breakaway Republics' version of history, there does seem to be a mercenary, at the very least, influence. Perhaps those mercenaries are actually not so much in it for the money, and it's part of something covert. But again, proving that is quite difficult, so we shouldn't jump into conspiracy theories.
Sure. Well, Earl Rasmussen, Vladimir Putin is indicating that this is a red line. But it's plural. Tell us what the red lines of President Putin is. Obviously, as evident from the news, one of them is the fact that Moscow is under the impression that the U.S. is building military bases in Ukraine.
Yeah, I think obviously we know one of those red lines is inclusion of Ukraine into NATO. I personally do not see that happening, although there is a lot of political pressure to it. I don't think the Europeans would be supportive of that as well, because they know that would be dangerous. You can talk about expansion of NATO into Ukraine. That's if you had actual military bases, that definitely would be in that area. I don't necessarily think that we have, training advisors, and you can put those in many different, modes or interpretations of that across the world with many different places. And those definitely are not considered military bases. Now, could they be using that as a means to hide potential increased growth in military presence there? Absolutely. But from a purely training military advisory perspective, I don't necessarily see that as crossing into that red line. Getting close to it, but I don't necessarily see that in that zone area. I think Russia would continue to seek to find a diplomatic solution versus a military solution, and then maybe we'll get into that later. But the issues now and the growth of a presence, or even a military advisory presence and training presence, increases the potential likelihood of perhaps Ukraine doing something on their own, maybe with some type of approval, but definitely potentially on their own that may escalate the situation.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's try to just break down this piece of news in all its different details here. Tim Kirby, Belarusian president, has warned of a joint response with Russia to this increased activity of NATO in Ukraine. Tell us why Belarus is involved here, and what type of joint response may it be referring to?
Well, why it's involved is because it would seem, according to the Belarusian president, that it wasn't that long ago that they tried to stage a color revolution against him. Because we have to remember that despite the fact that maybe on the surface he seemed very loyal to Moscow, he's been playing a good game of balanced politics his entire career as president. Only recently, when he sort of refused to submit completely to the demands of the West, basically they tried to do the old good old color revolution, and that has sort of forced his hand to shove him closer to Moscow. So essentially, in the past, maybe when the Maidan Revolution happened, when the first shots were fired in the Donbass, Belarus was much more neutral in many ways. In fact, that's why there were the Minsk Accords, because it was sort of in between the West and the East, and theoretically it was a neutral territory. But now the interest of their secret service is very much focused on Ukraine. Another reason would be that the very same type of people, and in some instances literally the exact same people who organized and executed the Maidan, were going up to Belarus to enact some sort of color revolution in Minsk. So there's a bit of a personal interest as well.
Okay, so do you agree with that, Earl Rasmussen, in terms of the involvement that Lukashenko has? Go ahead.
Yeah, I completely agree with that analysis. You've got, I think there was pressure to probably move more over. Lukashenko has been doing the balancing act. And I think basically he was put in a situation, and the West was supportive and if not complicit completely, but they were definitely involved with supporting the demonstrations and potential color revolution in Ukraine, and basically pushed Lukashenko solidly more into alliance in the Russia camp. You know, they always probably favored that, but Lukashenko really was, as was, you know, our other guest mentioned, really trying to straddle and play an independent role and be in the middle there. But this is this has become now more of a personal issue with him as well. So I absolutely agree with that position there. We're creating the West actually helped create this situation and the closer ties with between Belarus and Russia as well.
Well, when Lukashenko was asked, Tim Kirby, about what kind of response, he said, first, we did agree with President Putin that some kind of measure needs to take place. And when digging deeper, he said, these need to be actions that ensure the security of the two of our states. What do you think he means by that?
I think it goes back to what I was saying, that a lot of the color revolutionaries came up from Kiev to go try to change things in Belarus. In fact, the sort of Belarusian opposition with their white and red flags has a very similar mentality to the Maidan, Kiev sort of forces that won the battle of the streets in 2014. So in a way, it is for him, for Lukashenko, for Belarus as a whole, it is really a matter of national security. But also, when it comes to Russia, there are really only two issues that I think the public is really deeply unsatisfied with in terms of President Putin. Number one were the Social Security or pension reforms, depending on your terminology, which were very, very unpopular, let's say, and the handling of the situation in Ukraine. Ukraine is a very, very deep part of Russian history. Many would argue an inherent part, an inalienable part. And it's sort of like it's a real tragedy. For Russians, it's a real tragedy, and it's a tragedy so big that it actually, in some ways, causes an element of destabilization within the Russian system itself.
You mentioned Earl Rasmussen about Ukraine's, I guess, previous, perhaps, inclination to want to join NATO, and how Russia obviously has vehemently opposed that. Tell us why, and this has been said a number of times in the past years, tell us why that is not something that has happened, why it has there not been enough of a motion forward, either from Ukraine or from NATO, perhaps, for Ukraine to join it.
Well, I think, I think the population in Ukraine is against it. I don't think you have maybe marginally for it, but for the most part against it. I think they see them as, and in reality, Ukraine would be used as a ploy, a playground in the middle of between any type of potential conflict. Really, there's no benefit for NATO to expand other than further kind of isolate Russia for some reason, and I don't think it's good. It just is a poor decision on that side. Plus, if you look at the elections in Ukraine over history, you had the color revolution, the orange revolution, then you had the movement towards, and you had Lukashenko come into office later on. So you really got a political division there. You've got to the east to more favor Russian, to the west, you've got aspects of historically from Poland and Romania and Czech involved there. So there's a whole different, really have a different culture in Ukraine. It's made up of multiple different cultures. I think on a total perspective, most people would not wish there's not a conflict. Most people would not want to be part of NATO. And most would like to have a peaceful, in both from a military perspective and from an economic perspective, relationship with Russia. Ukraine really has a good potential, at least did at one time, being a bridge between that. But unfortunately, that has probably been put off for a long time, if ever, to reestablish itself. But I think that I don't think the popular support would be behind a not only the issue with Russia being against it, but I don't think the popular support in Ukraine, and I don't think the Europeans, the other Europeans would be, especially Germany and France, would be very excited about Ukraine's potential inclusion into the whole, the formal NATO structure.
Mm-hmm. Well, Tim Kirby, this is where I'd like to find out who's pushing whom into this scenario. And I'm talking in particular about NATO and the U.S. And I'm going to come at you with this fact, that the U.S. spends more on this NATO budget, from what we understand, than all of the rest of the NATO members combined, estimated to be about $730 billion. That's according to the U.K. Defense Journal. So given that, is the U.S. pushing NATO in its confrontation with Russia using Ukraine, or is NATO acting on its own? Because it seems that the U.S. is the one making decisions here in one respect.
Well, in terms of NATO, not just related to Russia, but generally, overall, the real moving force behind that is obviously the United States. I mean, if you look at the composition of NATO, maybe you could make an argument that England and France, which are both nuclear-armed and do have some military potential, may matter. But the overwhelming majority members are just absolutely pathetic, and even Donald Trump himself tried to actually force these people to pay up, to pay their 2% of GDP like they promised, because for years they wouldn't. And America was really footing the bill for all of that. So NATO is really an extension of America. Does it serve the interests of Europe, especially Western Europe? That's up to the viewer to decide. That's a bit of an emotional argument there on either side. But yeah, America's the driving force. And one of the key issues written when the Project for New American Century was written was that you cannot allow a new power to rise. And that ties into the somewhat already cliche musings of Zbigniew Brzezinski, who said that Russia will never become a great power or empire, I forget the wording, without having the Ukraine as part of it. So if his prophecy is to be believed, which there's a lot of logic to, Washington definitely does not want Russia to unite with its historic homeland.
Mm-hmm. Earl Rasmussen, you mentioned about the fact that there are some European countries, perhaps we can mention Germany, at least the signals coming from Merkel, that really do want to have a relationship with Russia. Maybe you can tell us what other European countries do want that. But
I would say obviously Germany, and there's, you know, both my contacts in Russia as well as Germany really have pro positive viewpoints of each other, you know, especially within the business community. And I think France, too. I think France would like to have increased business relationships, economic relationships with Russia. I think also if you look at probably Italy, Greece, two other ones, Spain potentially as well. So it really, there is a lot. And they see a lot of potential economic cooperation, which is beneficial to them, and especially in this current environment. And we're looking at increased economic growth. Germany obviously is potentially, you know, primed to be a major energy hub, thanks to Nord Stream 2, once that completed and is online. And we've already seen energy shortages. So this is Russia's easy access from both natural resources, but also from a trade and technology market as well. It's a positive win-win situation if we've got improved economic ties between Russia and Germany, France, and other European countries.
Tim Kirby, a certain incident happened recently, and I'm wondering if this is going to actually affect the way that NATO countries can unite or will be united against Russia. Because as one headline said, it appears that it's not going to be the case. NATO countries pondering alliance without Washington. Just one of the headlines. And this came after the debacle, as some say, over that AUKUS incident, that trilateral security pact between Australia, the UK, and the US. Obviously, France very ticked off about that. Are we looking at perhaps fissures there and distance between countries with the US so as to not follow the U.S. lead when it comes to Russia?
Well, in some ways, if it is true that the U.S. is in decline, it's possible to believe that trying to maintain and hold the NATO that keeps the somewhat arguably valueless Western European continental mainland under control might not really actually be that worth it going into the future. This could be the fact that I live in Russia, but there is a great amount of optimism towards this AUKUS move. For a lot of people in Russia, it's a signal that perhaps America and England are going to be more focused on sort of an Anglo-Saxon world rather than trying to dominate the European continent. Because as mentioned by our other colleague earlier, there is a great desire for many in continental Europe to make better business ties, especially with Russia. And the only reason that there aren't as many is simply the artificial need to enforce sanctions over a peninsula that no one cares about outside of Ukraine and Russia.
All right, a final question to you, Earl Rasmussen. Do you see what is happening between Ukraine and Russia going to the next level where there will be a military phase involved?
I would hope not. I think it's dangerous because of the most recent with additional aid and the rhetoric that goes on. I kind of agree with Mr. Peskov that you, there may be some unintentional, there may be, Ukraine may feel emboldened and kind of take it to on their own, thinking they'll be supported to do some type of military settlement rather than fulfilling the Minsk Accords. And that's that would be unfortunate. I think it would create a very, very bad situation. And I would hope the European allies maintain some control on Ukraine from stepping in that direction. But that's a dangerous area, and I would hope it doesn't escalate to that, but it could it potentially could to some degree, but I think Russia would rightfully put a stop to that very quickly if those military actions happen and could rapidly deploy forces to that. But I would hope we don't get to that direction and hope the West kind of controls Zelensky and crew.
All right, very well. We're going to have to end it there. Thank you very much. Let me thank our guests, Executive Vice President of Eurasia Center, Earl Rasmussen from Minneapolis. Thank you. And radio host and political analyst Tim Kirby. A pleasure. Spoke to us from Moscow.